Wake up. It's Sleep Unplugged, episode 20. Paradoxical insomnia. The insomnia you've never heard of. Welcome to the show. It's a special event, I think. This is episode 20. Can't believe we've made it this far. I really appreciate everybody's support. The show has done really well by any metric, and it's all because of you. And your participation with the show, your interaction, it really fuels my fire, makes this a lot of fun. So I'm Dr. Chris Winter, a neurologist and sleep specialist in Charlottesville, Virginia. Social media, if you want to talk to the show or communicate with me, it's Dr. Chris Winter on Instagram, Dr. Chris Winter TikTok, Dr. Chris Winter Twitter, if there is Twitter by the time you hear this episode. I've written two books called, one's called The Sleep Solution, Why Your Sleep's Broken, How to Fix It. You can find it on Amazon, Kindle, wherever books are sold. You can listen to it on Audible if you like. If you're really finding my voice positive, you can listen to me read the books. The second book is The Rested Child, Why Your Tired, Wired, or Irritable Child May Have a Sleep Disorder, and How to Help. We have a YouTube page where I upload the videos of these podcasts. And if you're watching it, you can see that I'm wearing a Philadelphia Phillies jersey or a shirt in honor of the Phillies and their noble effort in the World Series. I'm not going to talk about who they lost to. I just want to focus on the Phillies. They're a fantastic organization from top to bottom. Great people. And really appreciate all the positive things that they said about how important they think sleep is in terms of their management of their players, management of their staff, and their, you know, one of the small ingredients to their success. I will note now, frustratingly, that I am 4-for-4 in the World Series, won 3 with the Giants, 2010, 12, and 14, as well as one with the Dodgers in 2020. But I've now lost 4, 2016, the Indians, who are now the Guardians, lost, 17, 18, Dodgers lost, and now 22, Philly lost. So 4-for-4, but we're gonna win the next one. So keep that in mind if you're an organization looking for a sleep specialist. I'm batting 500, which is not great. Real quick correction from last week's episode, I mispronounced Karen Johnson's name. That's again at Dr. Sleepy Karen, a real crusader to eliminate daylight saving time, which was the topic of our episode 18. So we are now, if you're listening to this and you're in the United States, we're now solidly in standard time. Do you just feel healthier? I certainly do. So doctors like Karen are really crusading to keep us on standard time, which is the healthier time. And I mention that because we usually do a little reader mail or reader comment, and the comment I'll mention, I'm not going to mention the commenter's name just because it really wasn't a name, but there's a lot of comments about daylight saving time recently, and they're a lot of fun. I really appreciate you all sending your questions and comments in. Most people seem to uniformly want to get rid of it. It certainly get rid of that transition back and forth. Most people wanted to stick with standard time, but there were several people who said, look, we're on the pro side. And one person made the comment, more studies are needed to uphold the pro DST side. And I thought that was an interesting comment. And the response I gave was, look, this is just the science saying what the science says, meaning that nobody is going into it with an agenda. Nobody cares whether we stick with daylight saving time or standard time. We want the situation that's healthiest when you look at research about medical outcomes. We talked about this a lot in episode 18. So I just thought it was an interesting comment that you need to do more research that supports DST. That's kind of like saying you need to do a lot more research that supports donuts as the foundation of a healthy diet. So everybody who does research on healthy diets, my guess is, would love it if the research said, oh my God, the donut arm of the study is clearly superior to the non-donut arm of the study. Unfortunately, that's not happening with donut research, which really irritates Big Donut. I don't know what that means. And clearly it's not happening with daylight saving time. So anyway, one other real quick shout out. I'm going to give a shout out to my buddy and fellow sleep researcher and friend, Eric Prather. He is a professor of psychiatry and behavioral science at UCSF, has a new book out called The Sleep Prescription. So there's a series of books. There's the, you know, seven steps for the prescription for love and seven steps for distressing. He wrote the book, Seven Steps, The Sleep Prescription for Sleep. And it just was released. It's done really well. And so please give him a shout out if you can on social network. You can find him on Twitter. Great guy, really puts good information out there. And so just want to give a great congratulations to Dr. Prather for his wonderful work. I look forward to reading it. So let's get into insomnia. We have talked about insomnia before. Yes, it's the first Monday of the month, and everybody who's part of the Sleep Unplugged family knows first Monday of the month is insomnia. We do something related to insomnia, which I really look forward to every month because, like Dr. Prather, I really believe in good insomnia education. That's where the treatment starts. And helping people through a variety of different ways. You can read my book. You can listen to a podcast. You can read Eric's book. You know, there's so many great sleep minds out there that approach the problem of insomnia differently, that the answers out there. I tell people all the time, we're not waiting around to discover the cure for insomnia. It's cured. It's done. You just have to find your path to that solution if you're somebody who struggles with insomnia. And we've talked about it a lot too. So let's talk about insomnia in general. Insomnia is a condition where you're having a hard time initiating sleep. You're struggling to maintain it. You wake up a lot during the night. You wake up before your alarm clock goes off, which a lot of people are going to do during this transition to daylight saving to standard time from daylight saving time. And you're feeling like your sleep is non-restorative and poor quality. I would add in there that there also has to be a little bit of a psychological distress to it, meaning if I run into somebody who says, look, it takes me 2 hours to fall asleep, I don't care, it's hard to make an argument that that individual has insomnia. It's very common. 30% of the people out there are having symptoms of it, 10%. It's rising to the level of something really problematic in the adult population, and certainly common in young adults and kids as well too. When we think about insomnia, and I've mentioned this a little bit in the past, it's an interesting condition, isn't it? In the sense that it really relies on the patient reporting it. So when you think about other conditions, rash, GI bleeding, heart attack, stroke, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, psoriasis. Yes, there is a complaint. My skin itches, my chest hurts, but there's a lot of objective things that go along behind it. Oh, there's the MRI that shows the middle cerebral artery has been obstructed and that caused the big stroke, you know, unfortunately. Insomnia is a little bit different. It requires and relies heavily on an individual reporting the symptoms, right? So the clinician is at a disadvantage. I'll say really quickly too, I have a little bit of a problem where I always say physician, and I mean that just the random woman or guy you're talking to. And I've really been trying to do better about clinician, because that person who's helping with your sleep may not be an MD. That might be even a good thing in a lot of cases. So there's lots of people out there helping, nurse practitioners and PhDs like Eric Prather and all kinds of people. So clinician, really, really working on that. I work on a lot of things, and that's certainly one of them. So the clinician is very dependent upon what you're telling her, right? Hey, it takes me a long time to fall asleep, or I wake up, or I'm waking up too early. Like, all those things are important, and we take those things at face value. In fact, not only is the reporting important for the diagnosis, but it's also really important for the effectiveness of therapy, the work. I put work in quotations. We tried X. Patient says, well, it didn't work. Still having difficulty falling asleep, still waking up throughout the night, still waking up well before my alarm clock goes off, still don't feel good. It's not working. I've tried everything, or Dr. Wood, I've tried everything. I've been on 17 different sleeping pills, seen 10 different sleep doctors, and nothing works. Well, yeah, I read your book, it didn't work. Or I've tried cognitive behavioral therapy, it didn't work. Work, 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 work. What is work? What is work? Yeah, I tried your cholesterol lowering medication, it didn't work. Well, that's easy to see, because I took some blood out of your body and we did a lipid panel, and I see, yeah, your HDLs are still really high, you know, and your total cholesterol is astronomical. And I even checked it a second time to make sure it wasn't a lab error. You're right. This diet is not working. Adding fiber is not working. Adding this cholesterol inhibitor is not working. But with insomnia, it's different. It's the patient is in complete control. And that becomes a problem when we look at effectiveness of treatment. So the reporting influences what we are diagnosing and how we are treating the problem. And if you think about a primary care doctor, it becomes very amplified. They may not have that training that the sleep specialist does. So they're really in the dark here. Plus, they don't have the time to really get into it. So there's all kinds of factors working against things here. So there's always been this sort of notion about something we refer to as twilight sleep. That was sort of the older, antique sort of term for what we're going to talk about today, which is paradoxical insomnia. So when we think about twilight sleep, what we're thinking about is an individual who is asleep but may not be perceiving it. So twilight sleep then became subjective insomnia complaint without objective findings, which you can put two and two together and figure out what that means. Then it became sleep state misperception, which is still used to some degree. But the more formal term is paradoxical insomnia. And this was a natural outgrowth of individuals once we started to be able to objectively look at sleep. So let's define paradoxical insomnia. It's a complaint of severe insomnia. So it's an individual who's come to your clinic and said, listen, severe in terms of duration, this has been going on for years, but usually severe in terms of symptom description. It takes me 5 hours every night to fall asleep, or for the last 7 years, I'm lucky if I get 1 hour of sleep. Or in cases that we see quite frequently within insomnia clinics, I don't really sleep. It's been years since I've slept. You would think that would be a isolated, every now and then, not at all. Hear it all the time. And because this is a relatively newer concept within insomnia, and because it's a very different thing to not only quantify but describe, we really don't have great numbers for how many people have it. I've seen, you know, it's usually between reported as being 5 to 7% of the population. I'm sorry, of the population with insomnia. So we have to create a distinction right off the bat. Number one, sleep state misperception or paradoxical insomnia as a diagnostic entity. I am diagnosing you with this severe insomnia perception problem. Okay, 5 to 7% of patients with insomnia. But we need to differentiate that from an insomnia patient who underestimates their sleep to some degree. This is the first reason why paradoxical insomnia is problematic. It's the insomnia you haven't heard of, because we don't talk about it, because sleep scientists don't really agree about it. When I intrinsically, as somebody who sees adults and kids with sleep problems and insomnia every day, 5 to 7% is ridiculous. That's a ridiculously small number. But maybe not if you're using it as a full body diagnostic criteria, because it's very different than saying, hey, Chris, of the patients that come to you complaining of insomnia, what percentage of them underestimate the actual amount of time that they're sleeping or overestimate the amount of time it takes them to sleep or the amount of time that they're awake in the night? Oh, that it's huge. And we know that because we do sleep studies, right? So we do sleep studies and we can figure out down to literally the second how much somebody's sleeping. So it's not hard after the study to ask, hey, how was your sleep study? Was it tech nice? How much did you sleep? And they'll give you a number. In fact, you usually don't have to ask. It's usually, oh God, Dr. Wynn, that was a rough night. I didn't sleep at all. I mean, I have patients all the time. They're like, do we need to repeat the study? Because it was such an awful night. I just didn't get enough sleep to qualify as having anything for you to look at, right? Because I was just sitting there awake all night long. So it's generally something that we see in younger individuals, young to middle-aged people. And some people report it as associated with tremendous fatigue and sleepiness during the day. Some people report, incredible, stretches of not being able to sleep with no real impairment the next day. So this sort of the phenotype changes. It looks different in different people, but the core is a misperception of what's really happening. There is, just for argument's sake and to round this out, a negative sleep state misperception, which is essentially, this is what we're talking about. There's a positive one as well too, where somebody says, I think I slept X, and X is actually much more than what they slept. But that's a completely different topic. And so for the sake of this conversation that we're having, we're talking about people who are radically underestimating sleep. Because you can imagine that's going to create a lot more angst and fear of, dire health consequences than the person who's walking around getting 3 hours of sleep but thinks they're getting 8 or 9. They're never going to come to see you. Maybe if they wreck their car, but they're not going to, because they fell asleep at the wheel, but they're going to come like, I wrecked my car. Is it, how are you sleeping? Oh, I sleep great. So, that again, that reporting becomes extremely problematic. So we go from the very, very, very distant past and twilight sleep, which you can see referred to in, texts and things like that of antiquity, to the point where we started using polysomnograms. And the polysomnogram is a really fancy word for the sleep study. And when the polysomnogram began to be used back in the, I think the, I mean, the first polysomnogram was done, I think, in the late 1800s, God, 1870. I'm blank. I should know this. I'll put this in a tweet or something. But anyway, the things really got rolling back in the 50s and 60s. Bill DeMint set up his first Stanford sleep lab in the 1970s. And this great study in 1976 with Mary Karskinen and actually Emmanuel Christian Guillemino, who are just titans in the field. This 1976 report, and just keep in mind too, the lab was started in 1970. And just a year before this paper came out in 76, DeMint and Karskinen put out the seminal paper about the MSLT, the study we talk about sort of diagnosing narcolepsy or looking at signs of hypersomnia. So lots was being done to formalize the sleep study that we had. A few years after this, Colin Sullivan's going to discover the CPAP, which we talked about in episode 5 with mild sleep apnea. So a lot's happening at this time. So we've gone from this sort of makeshift polysomnograms of the antiquities to a more formalized use of the polysomnogram and research and the sharing of ideas, which is really what was happening out at Stanford in the 70s. So what was great about this study was they looked at 57 subjects who said that they usually slept 5 hours or less. So they're trying to find people who are doing just what we're talking about, reporting smaller amounts of sleep. What they found was fascinating. And So of the people that they actually recorded, these 57 people, the actual recording time was under 5 hours. So these people who said, "Hey, I sleep 5 hours or less every night," they actually found that in only 10 of the 57 subjects. So that was about 17%. About 17.5%, same number, slept between 5 to 6 hours, another 10 subjects. 31 subjects, or 54%, a little bit more, slept between 6 to 7 hours, and another 10% slept over 7 hours. So the actual number of people who are doing what they said they're doing and sleeping less than 5 hours is quite small. The vast majority of people are sleeping much more than that. If we look at sleep latency, the amount of time it's taking an individual to fall asleep, in the 46 subjects who said it took them an hour or longer to fall asleep, the sleep latency recorded was over an hour in only six of the subjects. That's 13%. It was between 30 to 60 minutes in 12. That was 26%. Between 15 to 30 minutes in 8, 14%. And under 15 minutes in 20 of the subjects. 43.5% are falling asleep in less than 15 minutes, despite all of them saying it's taking them an hour or longer to fall asleep. So from the data, it's basically saying that, look, about 20% or fewer than 20% are actually doing what they say they're doing. So this was a real seminal work. It's something I've thought about a lot since I read about it in fellowship, or maybe even before that. I think my mentor, Paul Surratt, who I've talked about, showed me that study, because I found it incredibly fascinating. So what we're saying is, patient walks into the primary care doctor's office and says, "You got to help me. It's taking me longer than an hour to fall asleep. You got to help me. I'm not even sleeping 5 hours." 80% or more of those people are not doing what they say they're doing. Now, it's important to say they're not lying. And we've talked about insomnia as a trauma before. That was episode six. So the point of all this is not to create a situation where we are exposing the lie. That is not the point of therapy. And I think that when people have read my first book, The Sleep Solution, for people who are really struggling, for people who are really traumatized by insomnia, these kinds of truths are extremely troubling, incredibly problematic. And it doesn't, for some people, it's liberating. "Oh God, I never really thought about this. And my partner's been saying this for years. So, oh, thank God, like this is a real thing that I'm dealing with." But for other people, it doesn't feel like that at all. So as that polysomnogram began to be used and other people started to kind of recreate this kind of information in their own labs or in their own experiences, this idea of sleep state misperception was born. So whenever an observation in medicine becomes routine, when something is being seen by a lot of people, there now becomes a drive to formalize the definition. And here is where everything just falls apart. And this is the reason why, fundamentally, I think you've never heard of this. It's not something that even the media talks about, even though it's something that's affecting so many people. And if they knew about it, could be transformative. So there have been efforts to try to do this, to try to describe a little bit more formally the nature of this misperception, to quantify it. And Anna Castellanovo, Dr. Maniconi, there's a whole group in Italy who really looked at this. Sorry, Maniconi, not Maniconi. In 2010, there was a study where they were measuring the error in sleep estimation. So they came up with this really novel idea. Let's do studies on individuals. We will ask them after the study's done, how much did they sleep? So we will get a subjective number from them. And then we will have an objective number based upon the actual sleep study. So what we're going to do is we're going to take that objective time, how much they actually slept, subtract the subjective time, how much they think they slept, and then divide that by the objective time, and we'll get an index. So the perfect index, not the perfect amount of sleep, but the perfect index is zero. I think I slept 5 hours. I actually slept 5 hours. So objective 5 minus subjective 5 equals 0 divided by 5 is 0. Perfect. Whether you slept 5 hours, 7 hours, 32 minutes, as long as you guessed, estimated that same number of what you actually slept, you're going to score a 0. So as they were looking at this, they're getting all kinds of numbers. And what they're seeing is that the misperception is almost completely uniform. Everybody's misperceiving their sleep, and it's almost always in the insomnia patient in the negative direction. They are underestimating the amount of time that they slept versus that positive direction we talk about. Forget that. That was just an example of people can do that. They're not seeing that in the insomnia group. However, in the insomnia group of people who are misperceiving their sleep, underestimating their sleep, they're kind of separating out into two groups, the moderate underestimators and the extreme underestimators. So in a study of 159 adults with insomnia, 127 had moderate underestimations of their sleep, 32 were extreme. And by extreme, and they called it misperception index, I think, the MI, the misperception index. So in 32 of these people, they had a misperception index of 0.9 or greater. So let me give you some random examples here. You are an individual who is sleeping 8 hours, but you think you slept 6. I mean, that's a pretty big miss. You know, you're missing 2 hours of sleep. So 8 minus 6, 2, divided by 8, 0.25. So you're miles away from the 0.9. So the 0.9 is essentially somebody who's sleeping, I think, somewhere around 50 minutes. No, I'm sorry. Somebody who's sleeping 8 hours thinks they're sleeping about 50 minutes. Let's take this back. Sorry. An individual who's sleeping 9 hours, they do a sleep study, they sleep 9 hours. That's their objective number. But they think they've slept about 0.9 hours or about 50 minutes. So after the study, how much did you sleep? You knew they slept 9. What do you think you slept? Oh, I slept about 50 minutes, maybe. That would give you the index of 0.9. Actual 9, what you think happened is 50 minutes. Massive underestimation. And like I said, these are not uncommon. So when you look at the actual formal definition of paradoxical insomnia, these types of methodologies have not been adopted, but it was the author's contention that we need things like this to sort of formalize it. Because what do you do with somebody who's a 0.4 or the 0.25 we just mentioned before? You're missing it by 2 hours. If you're somebody who's wants to sleep 6 hours, and you are, but you think you're sleeping 4, that's different, isn't it? The health of a person who's getting 4 hours of sleep versus 6. Let's go back to what we were talking about in the very first insomnia episode. We talked about episode 2 in the National Sleep Foundation's charts of what's a normal amount of sleep distribution for age. 6 is okay in some ages, older ages. So the difference between 4, hey, this is not normal for any age, to 6 is important. Does that person meet the diagnostic criteria of this more severe paradoxical insomnia? Probably not. But I think that we're really going to struggle if we don't recognize that there's a degree of misperception happening with this patient and probably a lot of patients with insomnia. So I really like this idea of using this like we would an Epworth sleepiness scale, which we've talked about. Are you a 22? That's a really sleepy person. Or are you a 10? That's a pathologically sleepy person, but you know, within the realm of what you might see, you know, versus somebody who's got an Epworth sleepiness scale of 2, not sleepy at all, which a lot of patients with paradoxical insomnia who can't sleep or are lucky to get 1 hour, they have that 0.9 index or above, have extremely low normal Epworth sleeping scales. This is the difficulty that surrounds these patients. So why? Who's at risk for this? Generally speaking, you're going to see this type of thing in individuals with a lot more chronic insomnia. You know, the individual who's been sleeping pretty well, and then all of a sudden something happens, and you know, the birth of their new child, the divorce, the job loss, it takes a while for this thing to really get going, because there's always been a theory that the rumination, the anxiety, the depression, difficult, you know, with coping skills, all these things sort of mix up to sort of turn that insomnia into something that becomes a lot more problematic. The fear of not sleeping, the fear of anything, that anxiety that we take with us to bed at night can dramatically affect the way we perceive it. And we know this, right? I mean, we know that sometimes what we think happens differs from what other people observe. Parents, spouses, it sometimes differs from what our Apple Watch tells us happened. And this is important. I mentioned in my very first book, I think we've all had issues related to paradoxical insomnia from time to time. For me, it was Christmas Eve. Wow, what an anxiety-laden time. All right, guys, let's get to bed, and you know, hopefully Santa Claus will bring you things off your list in some completely magical way. Like, you're gonna go to bed and this guy is gonna fly a sled onto your roof. You might hear it. If you were awake, you might hear it. And he's coming down a chimney and he's shoving toys and chocolate, candy, everything, like in a stocking, and you're getting the bike and the Barbie dream house and the Star Wars Death Star, like all of your dreams are coming true tomorrow as soon as you go to sleep. And by the way, if you don't fall asleep, he may not come because he knows stuff. He is aware of your sleep state. So being in your bed with your eyes closed, but you're really awake, that elf knows. And he's got a list and somehow he figures it out and he'll just, forget this guy. He's awake down there. I can't risk being exposed. And so I'm just going to go on to the next house. Like, there's a lot of pressure on Christmas Eve, if that is something that you believe in. So if you're not Christian, you're not a Christmas person, I'm trying to paint a picture of what it feels like to be that. Hey, good night. Go to bed, Chris. Get some sleep, because you know, if you don't fall asleep, Santa won't come. Good night. Oh, God. Oh, man. I mean, that's just, there were many a Christmas when my parents came in, they would say, let's go see what Santa brought. And you were kind of like, it's daytime. I'm not sure I actually fell asleep. I remember looking at the clock. I feel like I saw the clock all night long. And you're telling me it's already daylight, that something doesn't compute there. You didn't think about it too deeply because, again, you got some presents out there that are not going to open themselves. But there was that sort of feeling. And sometimes when you talk to patients and they'll tell you things like, I go to bed, I fall asleep. And most patients, interestingly, with paradoxical insomnia, fall asleep fairly quickly. The most common phenotype is get in bed, fall asleep pretty quickly, wake up after an hour or so, can't go back to sleep. They're done after that hour. Went to bed at 10, woke up at 11, just awake until 7:30 when my alarm clock went off, never fell asleep again. Was just there staring at the ceiling for 7.5 hours. That's the most common phenotype. So you can imagine for a lot of people, if you really question them, they'll say, God, you know, I mean, I guess I know what it feels like to go on a 7.5 hour car trip. I guess I didn't feel like I was awake during that time. Maybe I was sleeping some then. And, you know, sometimes my partner says that I do, and I don't know. I'm just not sure. My Fitbit shows weird things, so I'm just not sure about it. Other people, they don't want to hear it. And a guy said he moved to Germany, didn't sleep the entire time he was there. When you tried to question it or introduce a little bit of logic to the situation, do you think you could have survived this military intelligence job that you had in Germany if you hadn't slept for 6 months? Does that make sense to you? I mean, this is a smart guy. One of the things that has never been shown in paradoxical insomnia research is that it's because people are just not smart or not medically proficient or literate. This guy was super smart. He's analyzing data. So it has nothing to do with that. The guy said, look, I don't know what to tell you. I did it. Well, did you know the world record for sleep deprivation is, you know, 11 days and you went 6 months? Does that rattle your cage? And no, it does. I don't know what to say. I guess I've set the record. I mean, this is the kinds of conversations you have. It's like somebody telling you, hey, Chris, you've got a third eye in the middle of your forehead. No, I don't. I'm looking right now. I clearly have two eyes. You're trying to convince me something that's magical. Like, I'm not going to have any of it. So what is causing it? A lot of times, fear of insomnia is a big part of it. These individuals are very smart. They're smart about their health. They want to do the right thing. So the fear of the insomnia often drives it. The fear of not getting presents drives that Christmas Eve paradoxical insomnia that we should all come up with a name for. Y'all can tweet me some good names for the special paradoxical insomnia we all feel on December 24th if you're of the Christian persuasion. So what else goes on? We talked about higher levels of psychopathology is probably not playing into it, nor is intelligence or sleep intelligence. A big one is probably the number of nocturnal arousals, the number of times that individuals wake up. So there's lots of theories out there that are basically saying, look, people with paradoxical insomnia do not have great sleep. Nobody's arguing that they do. And what's probably happening is they are falling asleep, sleeping for a period of time, waking up, going back to sleep, waking up again. But in their minds, those two wake periods get fused. It's like splicing, you know, editing software. They're editing out the sleep, and in their mind, it all gets shoved together as being wakefulness, which is why a lot of introspective people will tell you, I definitely feel like I'm awake all night, but it doesn't feel like 7.5 hours, which is what I'm telling you. So I don't know what to do with that exactly, but yeah, it's not 7.5 hours, but I'm not aware of any kind of sleep there. Another interesting theory there is increased alpha. So when you look at a sleep study, we're looking at all different waves. When people are awake, there's a lot of alpha activity in the brain. So when we go to sleep, that alpha activity should go away and you get sort of, you know, when we talk about deep sleep, when we talked about sleep stages before, deep sleep or delta sleep or slow wave sleep, those slow waves or delta waves. Well, sometimes if you look at that slow wave, there's a fast wave over top of it. And I'll put some pictures of what we call alpha intrusion on Twitter. And if you want to look for different added things that we've talked about, just look at the keyword sleep unplugged extras, hashtag sleep unplugged extras on Twitter and Instagram, and you'll find all kinds of extra stuff that relate to the show. So Andrew Crystal down at Duke said, basically, look, a lot of these individuals with paradoxical insomnia have not only alpha intrusion, but even faster waves of beta and gamma over top of it that indicate a certain degree of consciousness, perhaps even when an individual is asleep, which is really, really interesting. So how do we treat it? We don't want to basically, we're not treating people by saying, aha, you're lying, you actually sleep more because we see it on sleep study, goodbye. It's really more about behavioral therapy and cognitive re-education. There's, you know, ECT for people with severe depression. So that I would shove all that into treating the anxiety, the depression can often be extremely helpful. I think sleep monitors certainly play a role. You know, as they get better, they become the referee, the arbiter of Did I sleep or did I not? This sleep doctor saying I sleep. I don't think that I do. My partner says that I do. So sometimes these sleep monitors can be extremely helpful and show that, hey, you thought you slept 2 hours. You actually slept closer to 5.5. So we may not be fixing the problem entirely, but we're taking people out of the box of you're not sleeping and putting them into the box of you're not sleeping, perhaps exactly the way we want you to, but that's a far cry from 30 minutes or 1 hour or 6 months in Germany where you don't sleep at all. So those third-party things, even snoring monitors, people don't snore when they're awake. So if there's lots of snoring going on that's being recorded by your cell phone, that should help people not only understand that sleep's happening, but maybe give them an avenue of treatment, which is essentially, hey, the snoring might indicate difficulty breathing. We've talked about sleep apnea, perhaps that overnight sleep study to diagnose that and get rid of the thing that's breaking up your sleep can make you not only truly sleep better, but actually feel like you're sleeping better because us getting you to feel like you're sleeping better is where it's at. So that's it. I thought this would be a short episode. It turned out to be a little bit longer, but I'm glad we really got to dive in because I feel like everybody out there, particularly if you're experiencing insomnia or dealing with it, it deserves sort of more a full-throated explanation of this because I think for a lot of people, understanding that or even knowing about its existence can really help you get out from under your insomnia. Again, thanks a lot. Episode 20. Yay! That's big time. Again, Dr. Chris Winter TikTok, Dr. Chris Winter Twitter, Dr. Chris Winter Instagram, Sleep Solution, and the rest of Child. Check out our Sleep Unplugged YouTube channel and look for the keyword Sleep Unplugged Extras on Twitter and Instagram. We'll put some more content up over the week. Hope everybody's daylight saving time adjustment went well. Hope everybody's feeling good and sleeping okay despite the transition. And we will see you again next week. Until then, sleep well.